Our intelligence and law enforcement agencies undertook that assessment in the first several weeks of this investigation. In March, they concluded that domestic violent extremists pose an elevated threat.
This place is now known as Trinity Site. In a moment in time, at this spot, in July 1945, things changed. In the instant of what happened here, the length of a war changed, along with the course of history.
Alamogordo, New Mexico, was established in 1898 with the expectation that it would be one of many communities supporting the western expansion of the railroad. For the next 35 years, the city and railroad grew in tandem. But by December 1941, when the United States entered World War II, Alamogordo was a small town of 4,000 people existing on its economic past in a small tourist industry. One element of the wartime expansion of the U.S. Armed Forces was the establishment of the Alamogordo Bombing and Gunnery Range, subsequently named the Alamogordo Army Airfield. In May 1944, Dr. Kenneth T. Bainbridge, a Harvard University experimental physicist employed at another, far more secret military installation in New Mexico, he led an expedition through parts of the state. He was looking for a remote place where he and his colleagues at Los Alamos could determine whether their efforts to transform the theories of nuclear physics into a dramatic new weapon, an atomic bomb, had been successful. The Manhattan Project scientific director J. Robert Oppenheimer, and that's where we get the name of this podcast/video, is Destroyer Worlds, is a very telling quote. I mean, it's a quote from Bhagavad Gita, though. I am become death, destroyer of worlds. But when he's telling you about seeing the first nuclear weapon going off, but
trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
Anywho, and he had come along for the ride to this remote area in New Mexico. And the two physicists were searching for a piece of territory measuring approximately 17 by 24 miles that was just far enough from Los Alamos to make the town safe from the effects of a bomb test. They found what they were looking for in the northwest sector of the Alamogordo airfield. This huge section of the state that was owned by the government, located about 60 miles northwest of the city and 210 miles south of Los Alamos. The flat scrub region was known from the Spanish colonial times as the Jornada del Muerto, the Journey of Death. And I actually have a book coming out that's got that title. I really love this. That is because the actual story is from this monk. I've looked it up. Apparently, it was a German monk during the Inquisition, and this is during, you know, he was a Protestant. And he was preaching as a missionary in that area of New Mexico. And apparently they, I forget exactly what they did to him, but it wasn't pretty. Let's put it that way. So, with the approval of the commander of the 2nd Air Force, which controlled the airfield, they staked a claim to the site, and Oppenheimer would give its code name Trinity, which is the name of this episode. Obviously, the Trinity test site. And it's reference to a sonnet by John Donne, and it's a tribute to a dead lover. So, and obviously, it's got the biblical connotation. And under the guidance of the Army Corps of Engineers, contractors proceed to convert the desolate territory into a test area. Three earth-sheltered bunkers with concrete slabs were built 10,000 yards from the designated ground zero. On July 16th, 1945, the bunker to the north contained recording instruments and searchlights, while the one to the west held searchlights and high-speed cameras. They had no idea what the hell they were about to record. I mean, they had a pretty firm concept, and it's pretty funny when we get to the hydrogen bomb in this whole saga, because they literally thought that maybe it was going to incinerate the atmosphere when they, you know, blew this thing up. And I just, I mean, we need to get rid of these weapons. It is just plain. I mean, can you imagine actually thinking that the Edward Teller was the guy who's doing that? And we'll get to him later on. We might get to him this episode. We'll see. But yeah, that was a possibility when the hydrogen bomb was being theorized. Like, well, it might incinerate the whole atmosphere. Yeah, fuck it. Let's do it. Like, Jesus. Hold on. Now, the device to be tested relied on implosion, the rapid compression of a plutonium sphere, by a symmetrical detonation of a conventional explosive. If the device worked as planned, the imploded sphere would be sufficiently dense to set off a chain reaction, producing an atomic explosion.
Boom!
Another type of atomic bomb, in the one that would destroy Hiroshima, relied on a gun that fired one mass of U-235, a uranium isotope, at another with the expectation that a chain reaction of fast neutrons moving at tens of thousands of kilometers a second would result. The exponential increase in the splitting of nuclei would result in an atomic detonation due to the energy released when nuclei break apart. While designers were so confident that the uranium gun device would work, they did not feel the need to test it. There was less confidence in the plutonium implosion bomb, which is funny because my understanding is the plutonium bomb was the one that's basically, you know, perpetuated itself over ages somewhat. Now that I think we mostly use hydrogen, but anyway, the uranium and plutonium that would fuel the bombs had been produced at two very distant locations. A massive complex at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, contained three means of producing U-235 for use in a bomb: an electromagnetic isotope separation plant, a gaseous diffusion plant, and a thermal diffusion plant. And we're going to more of these, but they tried these three ways, you know, to see which was the best. The plutonium for the test device at Trinity had come from another enormous site, the project's Hanford Energy Works in Washington State, where three plutonium production reactors and three separation facilities have been built. And, I mean, you can imagine the secrecy of this project, and there was a lot of censorship during World War II, as far as, like, because you really needed thousands and upon thousands of people to work at this place. And people talk to me about this sometimes. I've got a personal acquaintance I talk about, like, conspiracy theories or whatever. And they'll say, well, you'd have to keep this stuff secret whenever we're talking about this. I'm like, dude, that's completely possible, man, to keep it secret. Because, mind you, you have, and I've talked about this, if you were a whistleblower, or say you were experimented on during MK Ultra and you tried to come forward, who do you think would actually believe you if you, you know, went to them and said, oh, the CIA is experimenting on me, or I'm this or that? They've put so much disinformation, so much, I guess, discredit on anybody's name who's ever come out like that, that really people's own doubts and own delusions would be the censor. You don't need to do any censorship with a lot of this stuff. But with this type of stuff, a weapons program, particularly when we talk about how we would track the Nazis, you'll see it was very amazing that this was kept secret, because we can look at activities in any country and realize if they're doing nuclear experiments or not. And we'll get into more of that. So, so the Trinity test site, way out in the middle of New Mexico, they build this whole little platform and everything and blow up the bomb. And at 5:30, or it's 5:29:45. Local time, AM, so 0529 45. So anyway, the test device located on a platform on top of a 100-foot-high steel tower was detonated in a brilliant burst of light, equivalent to several suns at noon, filled the sky for 20 miles in every direction. And let me see if I can get some of that footage to edit over top of the video here. It's really, really remarkable stuff, and it got declassified at one point or another, where because they really had a shitload of soldiers out there, that, like, just to see what would happen to close combatants. And we're going to get into all this stuff, but during the Cold War, there's a lot of forward-deployed, like, nuclear mortars, tank rounds, stuff like that. We still have a lot of stuff in the arsenal, and we could still deploy it. It's just, and at that point, there was like, the idea was that you'd actually be fighting in a radiated battlefield. So, you know, to think to military planners that nuclear war isn't like a thing that they wouldn't in some crazy idea think, oh, that's a good idea, tactical nukes. Yeah, these people are that psychotic. I mean, literally, imagine if your whole job was finding out ways to destroy people and not destroy reputations or, you know, somebody's finances or something like that. Literally blow people up, strangle them to death. And figure out how to kill people, destroy people's infrastructure, all this stuff. That's what the military's purpose is. And we've let it just metastasize in the background for 80 years. And if it doesn't find enemies abroad, it finds enemies here. I think that's, thankfully we've had, and I really say this because I think honestly we're at a point in history where our own intelligence agencies are looking at our people and seeing, you know, whether it's the climate or the vaccine or whatever it is, anybody who's a dissident is now being seen as an enemy, when it's really the enemy is the people who are trying to destroy. And yet we've just let this thing metastasize because it's convenient for us. We've benefited a lot off the military industrial complex just by being the preeminent force in the world. And also they're just powerful. So I'm saying, if you were to come out and whistleblow on these people, first of all, it would be hard for people to believe you. And then beyond that, they would do everything in their power to destroy you up until the Epstein solution, you know?
As though you had removed the curtain and bright sunlight came in. Then I was impressed. Then I saw the brilliant flash, not looking at it, but looking at the sand next to me. And of course, you know, we all were very much aware of the point that in a few weeks, this would not be just an experiment. And some of us, including me, did have real doubts whether this should be used without first demonstrating it.
So, the big explosion, a huge fireball formed and lasted for several seconds. It then mushroomed and rose to over 10,000 feet before it dimmed. I mean, just a huge, massive cloud rose to about 41,000 feet. And light from the explosion was seen clearly in cities up to 180 miles away, including Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and El Paso. You can imagine the stories, because if somebody saw that, they'd be like, oh, I think they actually passed around something that said like a tanker blew up or something. You know, they had some type of, and also they've had these instances when they've done nuclear testing where they'll evacuate people from the area under a ruse, think, oh, there's some chemical plant. I'd have to look into that, but I believe they did that back in the day, in the 50s, and then they started doing them in the atolls, like the far Pacific Ocean, which, you know, isn't good for the Pacific fishery, but anyway, it's a little easier to keep it secret. But while it would take some time before Groves and Oppenheimer discovered just how successful they had been, that the plutonium device had detonated with the force of 20,000 tons of TNT, these numbers don't mean anything as far as like to our perception of things. First of all, because rarely do we ever get to see as civilians that amount of stuff blow something up, but it's just a explosion above any magnitude you've ever seen. And it's a miracle it hasn't been used, but there's a term called megadeth, And I know it's a badass band, but it's actually a term. It means millions of deaths. So they literally, the military planners, when they were discussing how many people would die from a nuclear war, it was expressed as mega deaths. I mean, they had to create a new goddamn term just because to make it more palpable for the military planners and everybody listening, because you could say, oh, just 20 mega deaths. But instead of thinking about 20 million people, because right when you start delineating the individual, you're thinking of all the family. You know, you start, anytime I tell you that, your mind starts comparing that these numbers, like remember, literally the heat and the energy coming off of a nuclear explosion, and just the type of explosion, literally, it's an atomic, a subatomic particle explosion. Rather than just like a concussive force explosion that blows air out, you know, because that's really what TNT does. It, like, literally, and you can see it when you see bombs dropping on the horizons. And this, like, secondary wall of sound and then light, you know, booming, or light and then sound, yada, yada, yada. But, and it was clear to all the observers when they saw us that the test had been a success. And we have the tape. Even before surveying the resulting devastation, and one of those present, an Isidore Robbie, would recall this: suddenly there was an enormous flash of light, the brightest light I had ever seen, or that I think anyone has ever seen. It blasted, it pounced, it bored its way into you. And by the time of the test, Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany, the catalyst for developing an atomic bomb, had already been defeated. But the Japanese had not been defeated. Germany had been unable to develop its own atomic bomb before the Allies defeated its troops on the battlefield and took control of German territory. And several years earlier, it had not been all clear to Oppenheimer and his colleagues at Los Alamos that they would beat Hitler's scientists in the race to to exploit atomic energy for military purposes. Mind you, Enrico Fermi was an Italian guy who, we're going to talk about all these guys who were the forefathers of atomic energy, but most of the developers of atomic energy were German. So, but here's the other thing, and we're going to talk about all this in grave detail. A lot of the great nuclear physicists were Jewish. And this is where identitarian politics right now in our current time is like your best and your brightest, you know. You don't get to choose who those are. And right now we have identitarians in this country who want to suppress people and kind of social engineer an outcome. And what we're seeing the effects of right now. By just not picking on merit and successes. And mind you, I'm not somebody who would get picked by merit or successes. I've always been an intelligent guy, so I'm not, you know, that's not a caveat. It's like, oh, I, you know, should have gotten more myself. I'm saying, as a society, look at what happened to Nazi Germany in this, and thank God they did. They drove away their most talented people, particularly in this, you know, theater of operation, so to speak. But yeah, that's what identitarian politics does. It devastates a civilization on a whole.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.